Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sports writer Michael Bauman is our guest this hour. Michael wrote a piece that appeared recently in The Athletic that caught our eyes. It's titled, "The Bleak Future of College Football. The sport is becoming an enterprise where underprivileged young men risk their health for the financial benefit of the wealthy." Michael is the author of Philadelphia Phenoms, the most amazing athletes to play in the city of brotherly love. His work has appeared on Grantland, Vice, and ESPN.com. Considering this is a big football state, I'm sure we're going to have more than a few phone calls this hour about football. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Michael, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Well, you're speaking to people in a state where at least the Green Bay Packers are a religion. I wonder if they still will be 10 years from now, Michael.
Yeah, this is one thing that I've always sort of said, is that I wonder if I will live to not only see the end of football as we know it, but to see the end of, or to write about it, because I wonder if, as more information comes out about concussions and brain injuries and the long-term effects of playing football, if there will be some massive tipping point that sort of spills the whole enterprise onto the floor.
Yeah, well, do you think? I think there will be. What do you think?
I don't think it's... I think there will have to be a tipping point. I don't think that the way the popularity of the game, you know, NFL and NCAA football are as big business as ever. And certainly right now, there are signs of youth participation maybe slowing down in future generations. But, you know, we're not heading towards, you know, in the next 10 years or so, everybody just not watching the Super Bowl anymore.
No.
So I think there will have to be some major event that changes a lot of people's minds.
You write in your article about better educated and wealthier people have more access to information about football's concussion crisis. So are you saying that there are quite a few people then who still don't have the information about how dangerous this sport and the dangers that are inherent in playing football?
Well, the poll that caught my eye and inspired the piece was it is a couple years old. It's from 2013, so I imagine awareness has only jumped up since then across all income levels. But you wonder, you know, people, you know, I've had this conversation with my wife, and both of us are the kind of, you know, upper middle class upbringing. Both of us have graduate degrees, and we're the kind of pointy-headed, soft-handed liberals who would keep our kids from playing football. I wonder if, you know, people who might not watch a Frontline documentary or read The Atlantic, or people whose families are a lot more ingrained in playing football and whose communities are a lot more ingrained in playing football, would be so quick to toss that tradition aside.
Mm-hmm. It is, this is just what I see when I drive through the city. I do see a lot of very, very young and many minority children playing football in fields, in schoolyards all across this city, really young.
Yeah, and I think that there was a I'm sure you're familiar with the movie coming out, Concussion. The guy who, the neurologist who Will Smith plays, Dr. Bennett Omalu, wrote a New York Times editorial that just came out this morning saying that kids under 18 shouldn't play football at all, that it is so injurious that they should wait until their brains are developed or they can make those decisions for themselves as adults. So, you know, I concentrated in the piece on college football for a couple reasons. One, because the student athletes aren't paid in any meaningful way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with an NFL player, you can make an argument that I don't find entirely satisfying, but there is an argument to be made that these are adults, these are professionals, they're well compensated for the the risks they undertake. But kids at the high school and college level are not. They're just doing this for fun. They do this because they want to get exercise, or they want to meet people, or they want to, you know, learn teamwork and leadership skills, and get in better shape. And these are all obviously worthwhile goals to pursue, but they're pursued at a great physical risk that I wonder if there's a better way to do that.
And then you look at this disparity. We have a racial issue to look at, and you also look at just the money issue. Coaches and administrators, you say in the article, are paid 6 to 7-figure salaries, which is just amazing to me. In college football, players are paid almost nothing, which begs the questions, who has the power and who bears the risk?
Well, that's the whole story, is we've got these incredibly well-paid coaches and administrators, and I'm not saying that they don't deserve. You know, college football is a multi-billion-dollar business. You know, these people who are an integral part of making it happen, you know, certainly deserve to be well compensated. But on the other hand, their labor force is not compensated at all in any meaningful way. You know, they get a scholarship, but you can tie. You know, I could have written an entire other piece on why getting an athletic scholarship isn't actually any sort of meaningful compensation for the risk of playing football. And what I found using the NCAA's own data is that at the Division I level, the football playing population is getting is becoming more and more African American, mm-hmm. whereas the higher up the food chain you get, the more power and the less risk a person who's involved in college football undertakes, the more likely it is that that person's white. And the head coaching ranks and the coordinator ranks, these people who are pulling in these multi-million-dollar salaries, these multi-hundreds of thousand-dollar salaries, they're almost 4 in 5 are white, and they're coaching overwhelmingly poor, overwhelmingly African-American players who get paid nothing and bear all the risk.
Yeah. You would have thought that it has reached a point, because it really has reached that point in terms of looking at what you're seeing on the field, where somebody would say, oh my goodness, what's going on here? All the coaches who are wealthy are white, and most of the players are black. Something's a little off.
Well, there's just enormous inertia, and with any system of injustice, I mean, this is a quote that I've been hearing tossed around, is with any system of injustice, you should look not at who's suffering from the injustice, but who profits from it. And so the people who have the ability to make change, the administrators, the university presidents, the NCAA, you know, the people with the most power are the ones who are risking least and gaining most. So there's no internal stimulus for change in any meaningful way in terms of paying players. And we've made incremental gains, but Northwestern's football team tried to unionize, which would have allowed them to exert a little bit of power on, you know, in making their own lives safer, in ensuring that they get fairly compensated, in ensuring that they get the time away from the football team to actually pursue the education that they've been promised. And the NLRB shot down their attempt to unionize last year. So there's the people who on whose labor and on whose bodies this sport is built are denied any kind of power, even to organize collectively. Mm-hmm. And without any sort of collective action, you know, one kid can quit the team. There's 84 others under scholarship on any given team. Whereas, you know, the coaches and the administrators, maybe there's a sense of, well, you know, maybe the kid, we could do a little better by these kids, but there's no impetus for them to change because everybody's still tuning in. I mean, even me, I wrote this piece. I'm going on the radio to talk about how unjust college football is. I spent 10 hours on Saturday watching college football.
Oh, Michael.
You know, this is the hypocrisy and the levels of cognitive dissonance among fans, even well-meaning fans, that's a barrier to change as well.
So where do you put your mind when you're watching a game?
I just try not to think about it. It bugs me. There's stuff not exactly head injury related that bothers me during the course of a game. You know, there's this the tradition is based in sort of, or the tradition of football and the tradition that is so ingrained in football culture is based in sort of a 1950s era conception of masculinity that, you know, that espouses violence. And not that I have any particular problem with violence. I have a problem with violence when it leaves, you know, when it leads to teenagers for most of a who, you know, who could potentially suffer life-changing injuries, you know, doing this for no pay. You know, so it props up when you see coaches, you know, getting in these kids' faces. And it just that power dynamic is really at play with certain coaches on certain teams who really drive home that they have the power, and the players who are the draw are interchangeable and expendable.
The NFL, you write, has made small steps toward improving player safety and minority hiring. Do you imagine they're going to step up those steps?
You know, I wonder if there's – I don't have a whole lot of faith in this current NFL leadership. I mean, it's not their job to make the game safer. The job of the commissioner and the owners is to make the game profitable. And any step towards equality, towards social reform, towards labor empowerment is done in service of public relations. So maybe there will be further steps to diversifying the ranks of owners and general managers and coaches. And they have made some steps towards hiring more African-American coaches. But even then, even in the NFL, where you've got a handful of African-American coaches, the demographics of the coaching staffs and the front offices don't even come close to matching the demographics of the people who are putting their bodies on the line every Sunday. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it comes back to we sort of assume as a society that everybody's out to do the right thing, where, you know, the past 20 years in American business have really proved that, you know, businesses will, I mean, maybe this isn't new, but businesses will do whatever they can to make more money, and all other concerns are secondary. So that's when it becomes incumbent on the public to check the profit motive of businesses. And, you know, I didn't offer a great solution to this problem, to, you know, making football safe or at least compensating players. You know, I didn't offer a solution because I don't know that there is an easy one.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to our audience and see if they have solutions to this problem. Our guest this hour has written a very interesting piece in The Atlantic, and it is concerning football. Michael Bauman is our guest. Michael is a sports writer, and his piece is the bleak future of college football. The sport is becoming an enterprise where underprivileged young men risk their health for the financial benefit of the wealthy. What do you think? 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, please leave comments there. What do you think about this? The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Michael Bauman. Our first caller is Boyd in Wautoma. Hi, Boyd.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, Boyd.
Thank you. And, I want to bring up a couple things. Just first off, you know, I am a football fan. I don't know if you can really say at this point that there's a war on football, although some have claimed that. But I agree with a lot of what your guest is saying, and I have a few concerns. Two of them, they're not really related, but I think very relevant, is I'm not singling football out on this, but I see a lot of tribalism. And thankfully, although I've never been at a game at Lambeau Field, that is one of the places where it really isn't an issue. People I know who have visited Lambeau Field, and they might be representing the other team, have always felt welcomed. The Packer fans have been like, hey, you know, you're just supporting your team. Would you like to have a bratwurst? But in a lot of other parts of the country, it is very tribal, and I've always thought that sports are meant to bring people together, not divide. And then the other thing is, I know your guest had brought up injuries. And I think one that is very underreported, and I think it's a lot more frequent than people want you to know, is how many young boys that are playing it, especially at the high school level, but even at the collegiate level, is they end up getting a serious injury, and it results in paralysis. There was even a young boy who played at Rutgers about 5 years ago, just was on the kickoff return, and I saw the play on YouTube. His head was down, and quadriplegic. And, you know, I tip my hat to him. He's been able to move on with life, and he's doing okay. But I'm thinking, I'm sorry, but no one should have to go through that because they played football.
Yeah, Michael.
Yeah, to the paralysis thing, there was a guy who went to my high school, who was a couple years ahead of me, named Adam Talaferro, who was an all South Jersey running back and defensive back, and went to play for Penn State. And his freshman year was paralyzed making a tackle, and he's you know, that just completely ripped apart the Penn State community, you know, the community of my hometown, and he became sort of a galvanizing figure in the community. And he recently, you know, he went through therapy and eventually regained the ability to use his arms and legs. So he was, you know, luckier than Eric LeGrand, who's the Rutgers lineman that Boyd was talking about. But yeah, I think the paralysis, you know, when somebody dies or is paralyzed on the field, that's something that we can see immediately. And that drives home the dangers of football, which are it's a related but different danger to the head injury issue, where you don't see these repeated small impacts upon the brain that cause damage, that cause plaque to build up in the brain, and can lead to paralysis themselves or lead to depression. You know, you don't see somebody like Hall of Famer Mike Webster or Hall of Famer Tony Dorsett who gets dementia or depression 20, 30 years after retiring. And that's really the more insidious thing about brain injuries, not to minimize, you know, the risk of paralysis or the, you know, 7 kids have died on the field in high school football across the United States this year. As opposed to, as far as the comment about tribalism, I agree. You know, it's as I grew up a Philadelphia Eagles fan and lived in Madison, Wisconsin for a while.
Oh, you did?
Let me say, yeah, the one thing that stood out about living there is how nice the Packers fans were. Really freaked me out a little bit. And, you know, I assume that, you know, strangers aren't that nice to you when you're, you know, in New Jersey or Pennsylvania. So it's, I always assumed somebody wanted something from me. But, you know, I don't think that the tribalism that he talks about is necessarily a bad thing. I think it's a release to these emotions that we all experience. We all need to get out of our system, even if it is an us against them kind of thing. And the overwhelming majority of football fans will just stick to trash talk or you know, more innocuous things, although some obviously do take it too far. So, you know, football is useful as a way for people to come together, but also, you know, as a way to blow off steam in more harmless manners. So, you know, that's why I think it's, you know, I'm not out here calling for the abolition of football. You know, I think it's an institution very much worth saving for those reasons.
Thanks, Boyd, very much for your call. Let's go next to Mike in Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hi. You know, I just feel that these kinds of discussions around that I've heard over and over about that touch upon the idea, especially in college ball, that we're taking advantage and disadvantaged either ethnically or economically youth. You know, this is the kind of idea that really separates at a higher level the politics that are currently in the country right now of the right wing versus the left wing, is that when we have people go out and write these articles and they're all worried about, and I think the description from a right-wing perspective, the description of pointy-headed graduate student, soft-handed liberals is just about perfectly captures the way a good chunk of the population feels about when they hear this topic brought up again and again, whether it be around injuries or just that they're not able to organize and get paid at college ball level. It all comes down to people that are sending their kids or kids that are striving for that brass ring. You're assuming that they're not able to absorb the message that this is a dangerous sport or that you have to take precautions or that maybe it's not fair. You're assuming that they're not understanding that message. Why aren't we thinking that maybe they do understand that message, but they're looking at this as an opportunity, and they, quite frankly, wouldn't or don't want someone to shut down that opportunity on their behalf because they're not asking for it.
Mike.
Well, I think that's a good point that, you know, these are not people who play high school and college football. You know, they're not adults necessarily by every definition of the law. But, you know, if you're 15, 16 years old, you're able to make a lot of your own decisions. If you're 18 years old, you know, we'll send you to war. So, you know, there's certainly a degree to which a lot of these people are adults. As far as this being an opportunity, you know, maybe it's an argument for football not being, you know, making football or making there be another way out of a situation or out of a bad situation for kids other than them playing sports or making it less risky. You know, maybe this has to do with reforming our public education system at large, reforming the way that you know, that public education or that public universities are paid for. You know, it's. Personally, I think it's completely unfair that public universities aren't free, that everybody, you know, if a bachelor's degree is the level of entry that you need to get a white-collar job in this country, you know, why do you have to take out $80,000 in loans to spend 4 years at a public school? So, you know, if we want to talk about making public education better or cheaper for kids from poorer backgrounds, you know, that's certainly a more worthy goal than anything that we could do about football. The other thing I would say to that is that if these kids are taking on the risk and if they do know the risk, you know, a lot of times they don't have a better option. So if they're going to do this and we're going to benefit from it in terms of building community, just in terms of being amused and having, you know, something fun to watch on TV, then let's make sure they're fairly compensated. You know, take away the restrictions on amateur athletes making money off of their own image. And the thing, this is an argument that I heard the first time from ESPN basketball analyst Jay Billis. You know, he said, if you're, you know, on any kind of other scholarship, it doesn't limit where you can make money. You know, personally, I got a full ride to college to study journalism. I was paid to work, you know, I was paid to work for the student paper, and I was allowed to freelance for, you know, for beer money and rent money. You know, that's how, you know, that's what I did on the side when I was in college is, you know, I worked for, as a freelance writer and copy editor. You can't do that. You can't make money off selling jerseys or signing autographs if you're a college football player. There are instances of, you know, Jeremy Bloom, the former University of Colorado wide receiver and Olympic skier, had to give back his endorsement money from skiing or they wouldn't let him play football anymore. So, and there are other instances of college athletes who are trying to make music careers, for instance, and aren't allowed to use their own image to promote their record. You know, this isn't about providing opportunity. This is about maintaining control over people who don't have any other options.
Michael Bauman is our guest sports writer, wrote a piece that we thought was interesting, The Bleak Future of College Football, which appeared in The Atlantic. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Michael, here's a tweet that we got from Mac Daddio, and Max says, I'm a big football fan. I also have a 4.5-year-old son. As the game currently stands, I would not let him play when he's old enough. And my question to you, when you cited those polls from NBC and the Wall Street Journal, the number of parents who would have concerns, it would seem to me as though that number is only going to grow. And so the question is, who eventually is going to play football?
Well, the thing is that the kids who maybe don't have parents who are as involved or who don't have other ways of paying for college, you know, and that's the most disturbing part about this to me is that particularly as college football is at its most popular in the South, we're heading for an unpaid, poor, you know, mostly African American labor force operating for the benefit of the of everybody else, including, you know, richer, better educated, largely white fan bases who don't want to risk their own kids' safety. And so that's why, you know, just pulling your this is the thing that I kind of ended the piece with, because, you know, I wouldn't let my kids play football, but just because my kids aren't involved doesn't mean that other people's kids aren't being exploited. And so, you know, if football is going to build a community, then we ought to take care of the entire community, regardless of whether we personally got skin in the game or not.
But don't you think eventually that the entire community, those who are privileged and those who are not, will realize that this is a dangerous thing to do? And so everybody will say, don't do it.
Well, that's where we go back to the first thing I said is, you know, I wonder if we're going to see, I don't know that we'll see the end of football, but I think we'll see the end of tackle football as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the NFL is sort of peddling this line that there's an equipment breakthrough to be made. I guess that's possible. It's unlikely because, you know, they talk about improving helmet design, but helmets don't protect against concussions. They protect against skull fractures. So it's unlikely, at least, you know, barring some sort of technological breakthrough, which I guess is possible, or maybe we change the rules of the game. Maybe, you know, we go to soft helmets or scrum caps, so mm-hmm. people aren't so willing to lead with their head and their face the way they are now.
Right. Mike, thanks for the call. Dave in Minocqua. Hi.
Hi. I guess I was just comparing in my brain the fact that we haven't progressed very far from the Roman gladiator fans. You know, certainly, you know, they were a little more barbaric, I guess, as they actually knew they would actually see a killing, you know, but when we sit and watch the football game, we just know they're slowly killing themselves. I realize the way society is set up, I understand why even if the poor kid who knows that this is dangerous is more than willing to take the risk just to get out of poverty. And I guess for the same reason those people go into the military, to get out of poverty and, you know, make some money, at least have a job. I mean, maybe we could broadcast the military getting killed. That would be barbaric enough. So I guess that's all I have to say. So
thank you so much for the call, Dave.
Yep.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah. No, the gladiatorial parallel is certainly not a new one. I mean, it's sort of been valorized to a certain extent that this is an outlet for violence and an outlet where, you know, this man who triumphs over strength and will, you know, through his own strength and willpower is on display and is valorized the way gladiators are. And we're sort of slowly coming to the horrifying realization that there's a flip side to that. You know, I don't know. You know, I don't know that I have a whole lot more to add other than, you know, it's a comparison that's definitely been made before.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of emails coming in. This one is from, I lost the screen. Tatcha? More people need to be aware of the true cost of college sports. There's a great documentary on Netflix, Schooled, The High Price of College Sports. It explains the entire college system from its birth to present day. Also, Michael, you are encouraged to stop watching college football until these players are truly compensated. You are part of the problem just by watching.
So I address that in the piece too, is that the problem with just removing yourself from the system is, and, you know, removing yourself from the system as a fan, and in my case as a commentator, is that if you just say, I'm not going to be involved in this, and wash your hands and walk away, then who's left in the system other than people who are okay with the status quo existing as it is? You know, I don't think we're anywhere near close to the kind of critical mass of where a boycott or a mass defection would do any sort of financial damage to the NFL or college football. So, you know, I think it's better to be involved in the system and try to agitate for change from within, you know, in such small ways as can be pulled off right now. You know, little things like, you know, you saw the Power Five conferences have increased scholarships to full cost of attendance. You know, just little things like that are the kinds of progress that are going to be made. And I don't think that, you know, this is one thing where, you know, this is totally my opinion and I could be wrong, and, you know, I respect people who disagree, but, you know, I think the best way to enact change is to remain within the system and try to make that change happen, instead of just leaving the people who are okay with that level of exploitation in charge. Mm-hmm.
Dave, thanks very much for the call. Ted in Gordon. Hi, Ted.
Hi. I would like to make the observation that everybody that ever played football from, well, probably Pee Wee, certainly junior high up through high school and college, and was on the field either during practice or obviously during game, knows what goes on out there far more than people who had never played the game. In effect, there are multiple small concussions that don't go reported. I used to get plenty of them. I was starting in ninth grade all the way up through playing 2 years at the college level. And nobody raises their hand and says, "Coach, take me out. I just got kicked in the head. I don't know what day it is. You just hope the next play doesn't come your way." And everybody ever played football knows what I'm talking about, but it's a very rare kid on any level that's going to say, "Take me out of the game." There are an awful lot of concussive or slightly sub-concussive, if that's the proper technical term, hits that are going on out there. And I wouldn't let any kid of mine play football, and my friends who do have children of that age, I say, tell them to play soccer or something else, because a lot of the damage that's going on the field, and I love playing football, and I like to watch it, but I'm trying to beat myself off of it. A lot of the damage is never reported, and it isn't known, and a lot of coaches either don't know or they don't want to trumpet the fact, and it makes me wince to see some of these plays, because all the commentators possibly on television, "Oh, what a hit, that's a great hit, oh, my these guys are tough," but they're not, they don't know what's really going on, mm-hmm. because nobody's talking about it.
Michael.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And that was the truly horrifying thing that came out of the out of all this research that's been going on for the past 10 years or so, is that these subconcussive hits that you don't have to get your clock cleaned in order to suffer irreparable brain damage. It's just, you know, you look at two sets of, or that two linemen just sort of, you know, running up and shoving each other, you know, 60, 70 times a game, and they knock heads together, and those little hits do accumulate. And that's something that, you know, Ted mentioned soccer. That's something that the U.S. Soccer Federation is doing in the youth ranks right now. They're investigating whether it's safe for young kids to head the ball in soccer, because soccer delivers those same kind of, heading the ball and accidental collisions deliver those same kind of subconcussive hits. And, you know, they're actually making proactive steps in order to try to make that game safer. But yeah, it's jarring to go back and look at old game footage from, or old, even old video games from like 10, 20 years ago, and talk about look at how they talked about hits and looked at how they talked about the violence of the game. Because we all sort of knew that getting hit in the head and getting knocked out was probably not good for you in the long term, but people didn't take it as seriously as they do now. And there was a cavalier attitude towards violence. I think even as recently as 10 years ago, there was a segment on one of the big shows where they showed, it was called Jacked Up, and they just showed all, you know, all the huge hits, all these people like, you know, getting hit in the head and losing their helmet and just all these things that really make you cringe right now. And that was not that far in the past. So, you know, I think Ted's exactly right. You know, it does make you, wince when you're watching the game.
Yeah. You know, thanks, Ted, very much for your call. Ellen in St. Francis. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Great show, as usual.
Thanks.
I just want to share my son's experience. When he was quite young, probably, you know, we had him playing soccer, maybe from the age of 5 or 6, just real low key, you know, not real threatening, just for fun. And I was out in the street throwing the football with him from the time he was really young. Then he was probably about in fourth grade, and it was time to sign up for football, which they had a Pee Wee League here. We let him decide. He decided to play football. Then he's the star of the team in high school, you know, is having a fantastic career. 2 concussions.
Oh.
Then, shortly after that, he was hit by a drunk driver.
Oh.
Another concussion. So here, now he's 23 years old, can't play any contact sports for the rest of his life.
Oh, Alan.
You know, what a bummer.
Right.
And it's like, and we were older parents, you know, and when we had him, and if I had to do it all over again, I would absolutely not let him play football. I would probably, you know, steer him into other sports that don't have the risk. And it'll be interesting to see what he does if he ever has children, you know?
Yes.
But it's just, it's too hazardous. It's really not worth it,
yeah.
You know? And then when I hear all of the anecdotal stories from him, you know, about you got to get in there and get out there and kill that guy, and, you know, it's just... I just think there's other ways to meet the same goal where our kids aren't put at risk to the degree that they are.
Yeah. Michael, thank you, Ellen.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, there's a couple things that I'd like to add. Obviously, you know, firsthand experience like that, there's no substitute for that. But, you know, one of the dangerous things about repeated brain injury is each one makes you more susceptible to concussions in the future. Mm-hmm. So once you get that first, or even that first reported one. And this sort of circles back to something that I meant to bring up after Ted's call, is that this macho culture of you, not only you've got to go out there and kill the guy, but playing through injury and sacrificing yourself for the team. You know, that's one thing if you're, you know, at war or if you're in the NFL, but you know, these kids in high school, they're going to play towards the, you know, until the end of high school, and then they're never going to pick up a ball again. And you know, what is that worth? And are you going to take yourself out of the game? And there's a strong normative compulsion not to do that, not to report injuries, you know, because you don't want to be seen as giving up on the team, or you don't want to be seen as fragile or
sure.
weak,
yeah.
or on a professional level, injury prone. You cost yourself money by getting that injury prone label. And there's a strong disincentive to take care of yourself, which just, it's worse the lower down the chain you go, and the more power the coaches have and the less power the players have.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ellen. Good to hear from you again. Let's go to Brad in Madison. Hi.
Hi, guys. I just want to say that I really am in agreement with the bigger concepts that you're presenting with your article. Just the idea of when we find out that jobs in our society are challenging or difficult, you know, it's going to be the lower-rung individuals that end up being left doing that job. I'd like to comment on the fact that I played high school football on a number one ranked team in the state. I played small college football, and now that I know what I know about all this, I wish that somebody would have informed me. And to the caller a long time ago who said that, you know, kids know what they're doing and they're making choices, when I was 10 and 15 and 18, I would have done whatever my dad wanted me to do. I would have done whatever my town wanted me to do. When we were winning, the reinforcement was huge.
I'm sure.
You're just not going to back away from that. And so you really don't have a choice when you're buying into this kind of thing. And I'd just like to, one last other comment. On another angle, I teach a psychology of men class at the college level. And we talk about the hyper-masculine kind of aspects that go into this. And so there are just so many things that are important that the author is addressing, that now as a middle-aged man who's a dad and a partner, you know, kind of growing up in that hyper-violent kind of way of being, you know, it took me a long time to kind of craft a new way of being to understand how I wanted to live in this life. So I think it's a really important topic. I'm glad you guys are talking about it.
Thank you so much, Brad. Well, that's an interesting call, Michael.
Yeah, that's you know, two things about that is every time this comes up, you know, you hear stories, you know, people like Brad either in the comments or calling in to say, I played football, I don't know what damage that did, I wish I hadn't. And those are, you know, those speak volumes. And the other thing is the psychology of hypermasculinity thing that he brought up is just so fascinating to me. And it's such an underreported part of this story is, you know, there are three ways that I could have addressed this issue. One is the privilege and race aspect that I did use. The other one is the economic aspect. Should we pay players? And third is, what about this culture of violence and masculinity in sports? And that's something that you don't hear get talked a lot about. And mm-hmm. for, you know, there's a strong, the way we talk about being a man in today's society depends so much on this outdated notion of physical strength and violence that plays into the way that football is talked about and coached. And, you know, it's something that I don't think we talk about enough, and I'm really glad that Brad brought it up.
Yeah. And then the role of women, too. This isn't true of all teams, and not as much certainly for college sports, but come on, the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders? Are you serious? What year is this?
Well, you can go back and read on, and Deadspin and other places have covered just the way that cheerleaders are mistreated and exploited. They don't, you know, they don't make minimum wage. They have to pay for a lot of stuff out of pocket just for, you know, it's a privilege. You know, teams treat being a cheerleader, which is an incredibly demanding job, as a privilege that allows the team to make all sorts of physical and economic and time demands on these women who actually, you know, they have to hold down full-time jobs. They're, you know, they're lawyers and teachers and whatever else that they are first and foremost. To say nothing of, you know, what does it say that these, you know, you don't need women with pom-poms to get the crowd pumped up. You know, they're not strictly necessary. It's just to have women in short shorts and sports bras, you know, dancing around out there, you know, and there's a whole argument to be made about that. So, you know, but I guess one problem at a time. We've only got an hour to talk about this.
Michael Bauman, sports writer, is our guest this hour. He has a piece in The Atlantic, "The Bleak Future of Football. The sport is becoming an enterprise where underprivileged young men risk their health for the financial benefit of the wealthy." Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Pam on Facebook, Michael says, in the U.S., working classes have traditionally paid their dues with their bodies, miners, railroad workers, etc. But A, those were essential services and most often unionized. College football used to be collegiate, but now is an industry generating tremendous profit. Entertainment, not an essential service.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. Yeah, it's a huge business, and you really got to look at who bears the risk of this dangerous job. You know, I'm not saying that this job shouldn't be done, just who bears the risk, who reaps the benefit, and who has the power, and, you know, sort of see if that squares with whatever conception of fairness or justice you might have. Yeah, that's, I agree entirely.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, Fox River Valley. Hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the program. Two previous callers made two of my points that I've always considered professional sports to be the bread and circuses of our society. If any parent thinks they're giving a 6, 7, 8, 10, 12-year-old the choice to play or not play, they are misguided. When we dress babies in football jerseys and start throwing footballs at them at 4 months old, their decision, their free will, is basically gone. They are going to do whatever their parents have indoctrinated them to do. My final point is that the domestic violence rates go up in Northeast Wisconsin when the Packers lose. Mm. Have a grateful day.
Thank you, Jonathan. Michael.
Yeah, I think his point about getting kids into football young is a fair one that, you know, we can argue about whether 16 to 22-year-olds are making their own choices when they play play football. But obviously, like, a 6 or 7-year-old doesn't have that choice. And, you know, I certainly don't see any compelling reason for them to be playing tackle football. You know, maybe we get them out there playing flag football. And, you know, if it's important to get kids involved in the sport young, you know, that's an obvious, safe, much, much cheaper way to do it than flag football. And the other thing is, there, to his point about domestic violence, it's we talk about there was a great article by Meg Rowley on Baseball Prospectus about Jose Reyes, the baseball player who was recently arrested on domestic violence charges, and there's something that she touches on that we don't think about domestic violence as being a huge problem in other sports the way we do in football, because violence and the game itself are inextricable. And I wonder if there's some sort of connection there. Obviously, you know, not knowing the data intimately myself, I can't make any definitive conclusions about that, but you know, it's something worth thinking about.
Yeah. Thank you, Jonathan. Jan in Appleton. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Jan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Okay.
You touched on this briefly, but, you know, I just wanted to mention about the fun factor of playing football. My five-year-old grandson is playing flag football, and he's begging to go to the next level. He's having fun. So I think that most football players now, a lot of them do it because it's fun. So I understand about the compensation and injuries and everything, but, and of course, the parents will make that decision. And, you know, a lot of them, like I said, they play because it's fun. They don't understand the risks.
Mm-hmm. Michael.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And it's important just from my own experience, it's important to get involved in stuff and, you know, be part of a team. But, you know, that doesn't have to be tackle football. It could be flag football, but it could be another sport. It could be music. It could be any sorts of other programs that, you know, schools are unfortunately offering less and less. And this goes back to a point we made way back in the past about public education funding. But yeah, kids get into this, they get hooked because it is fun.
Mm-hmm. What kind of response are you getting? Are people mad at you?
I have very purposely avoided the comments section on on The Atlantic. You know, a couple friends of mine have shared with me some highlights that you know, some of which are probably not appropriate for public radio. But you know, I've made a conscious decision not to seek out what other people think about it, because you know the response has been good now, but obviously there are other people who are threatened by what they see as.
Yes.
People coming in from the outside to attack an institution they love.
Yeah. And how much money is involved with all of it, Michael?
It's tough to say. It's in the billions, definitely.
Goodness.
You know, NFL profits, I think $25 billion is
the
number
is
that gets
really?
Tossed around. That was Roger Goodell's goal. $25 billion in revenue. I don't know if he's hit it exactly yet. But the money is obviously a little bit less in college football, but it's, you know, it's definitely in 9-10 figure territory.
Whew.
You know, this college football playoff, it'll draw, you know, millions, tens of millions of viewers for every game. You extrapolate that onto how much ESPN spends, how much Fox spends, how much, you know, there was a 30-something million dollar renovation project at my alma mater, the University of South Carolina, which is, you know, it's an SEC school, but it's not like Alabama or Texas or anything. And if they're spending tens of millions of dollars on practice facilities and scoreboards and $3 million on a coach, all that adds up over 120-odd division or FBS programs.
Jan, thanks for the call. Final call, Michelle in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi, thanks so much for the topic. I just want to say I have two boys that are 12 and 15 now, and when they were younger, they faced a lot of pressure to play tackle football. They're both very athletic, and coaches, gym teachers were pressuring them and pressuring me. My sons were pressuring me, saying, you know, we're the boys whose mom doesn't let them play.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept saying no, just no, no, no. And they don't play. And just this year, my son, who's in high school, said thanks, because I wouldn't want to be out there and, you know, he does other things and plays tennis and all these other things. And so to the parents who are thinking, well, what am I, you know, it's going to hurt my child to not do it, or, you know, you can say no, and it can turn out just fine.
Hmm. So. Thank you. Thanks, Michelle. Michael.
Yeah, you know, my parents didn't let me play football growing up, although that was probably not for any brain injury related reasons other than I'm slow and probably wouldn't have been very good at it. But, you know. Certainly, I wouldn't expect anybody to let other people tell them how to raise their kids, you know, whether it's someone on either side of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. There is pressure, though, to do it. You can see it. Yeah, how can there not be? Look at how it's glorified in our culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a shocking thing about, you know, I just moved to Texas recently, and you know, I came from a high school where the biggest sport was girls field hockey, and then coming and seeing these 15,000 seat public school stadiums in
wow.
a state that barely funds public education at all. Like, this is incredibly important. So I can't yeah. imagine what that pressure would be like for someone who actually had athletic talent to pick up a football.
Amazing. All right, Michael. Did you know my husband's name is Michael Bauman? Isn't that weird?
Oh, no kidding.
I know. You should meet each other.
Yeah, we should.
And he's a sports writer. He's a baseball writer. Isn't that weird?
Does he work for MLB.com?
Yeah, he does.
Okay, yeah, I know his work. People get me confused with him.
Do you know him?
Online from time. Not personally. I've read some of his stuff.
Yeah. Though. Oh, that's interesting. So I wouldn't forget your name this hour. Ever.
No.
No, all right. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, Michael Bauman, sports writer, and his piece appears in The Atlantic. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing this show, and KP Whaley for on-air production.